We are talking once again with Job Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Or at least part of the show will be giving us a wrap-up of this past week's news.
That's correct.
Good afternoon.
Okay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good morning. Good evening, depending on when you hear this final recording. So,
And it will be the final recording. No, wait. That came out wrong.
I'm gonna have to edit that. Just kidding. So no Maria this week, but we do have. You all should be receiving your ballots for the August.
Yeah, they are in the mail. You should have gotten them by this weekend, or at latest Monday. And you need to return them by Tuesday, August 2nd. That's a couple weeks away. So there's a large network of drop boxes around the county. The King County Elections website has a very handy list of them all. But that's the most secure way to do it, especially since the former guy eviscerated the U.S. Postal Service, and they haven't replaced any of those sorting machines since then. So I would recommend using the drop boxes. If you haven't gotten a voter's guide, that also is at the King County Elections website. And if you need to register, you can still do that. You have to do that in person at this point. But that instructions for that are also at the King County Elections website. And lest you think, oh, well, it's the primary, it's the middle of summer, it's not very important. This is kind of a peculiar primary. For some reason, Washington State has them in the middle of August when everybody's out enjoying the nice weather. But what is at stake this year, there are no initiatives on the ballot, at least not in August. There will be in November. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But there also are not any judges on the ballot this time. So what is on the ballot, aside from federal offices, is the Washington State Legislature. And if the Republicans have the kind of wave that some pundits are expecting this year, they could very easily take over the House of Representatives and maybe even the state Senate. That should be a nightmare scenario for anybody who remembers the 2010s when we spent several years with a gridlocked legislature in Olympia because the Republicans controlled one or both houses. They didn't control the governor's mansion, and so everything was gridlocked. We couldn't get budgets passed. We couldn't get legislation through. The state Republicans, you may not have noticed because they're not really in power at this point. They're every bit as nuts as their national counterparts. So, it's not a good choice to allow them back into power. So I'm going to be spending a little bit of time on, suburban races that we don't normally get to, on this show. But this is our, we do this a couple times a year, once for the primary, once for the general. And the same caveats always apply. Do your own research. This is just, my take on these races. It's not necessarily, telling you how to vote, but, there's a lot of different sources on a lot of different, good websites that have information on these candidates out there. So go look at them yourself. For instance, there are 18 people running for U.S. Senator for Patty Murray's seat. I guarantee you that 16 of them you'll never hear from again after the primary is over. But it's something you need to do your own research for. So please do that and go out and vote on or before August 2nd.
Yeah, it's really kind of a bare minimum of what people can be doing to affect change. Obviously, voting only creates a little bit of change in the big picture, but
voting is really the end product. The kind of systemic change that we need on a lot of these issues starts with grassroots organizing. And, you know, eventually you work your way up to candidates who can put together the kind of winning coalition that gets them real power. And that's that end product is what we're seeing in a lot of these legislative races. You know, some of the candidates here are former community activists who have moved on up. And that's a good thing. But again, you know, if voting were itself changed things, they'd make it illegal. And of course, in some states, they're trying to make protest illegal, but because it does change things. So yeah,
well, go out,
get involved. You know, and it's a lot easier to effect change at the local level than it is at the national level. You know, all the big ticket items that we talk about, reproductive rights and climate change and all the rest of that, those were all hugely important. But, you know, the kind of change that we want to see starts with local politics. It starts with the city and the state politics because you can actually get in and affect change there. So anyway, that's my scolding lecture for the day.
And you mentioned that King County has drop boxes that are available, and that is your preference. I actually have had good success with mailing, but I get it mailed in early. But just this week, King County was putting in at least one additional drop box. And I just say that because there's literally states where they are removing drop boxes as we speak.
No, there are states that have outlawed them.
Well, that too, but I'm just saying, you know, it's – like this is all happening in real time that just as quickly as, you know, we're trying to affect things via the voting system. There are numerous states, as I know most listeners know, that are removing those mechanisms so that people can no longer vote. So clearly it must be having some positive effect. Otherwise, they wouldn't be dismantling it as quickly as they are.
Right.
So starting out, where would you like to start?
Well, let's start with the federal offices.
Okay.
Just go in the rough order that they will appear on your ballot. Senator Patty Murray is up for re-election this year. I am not a fan of Patty Murray. I've never particularly been a fan of Patty Murray. But she is a reliable Democratic vote in a chamber that desperately needs a Democratic majority of more than Kamala Harris. In other words, something that removes power from Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema so that I never have to think about them again. So that starts with reelecting Murray. She has a kind of token Republican opposition this year. And then there are, I believe, 16 other candidates running that are at least listed on the ballot. That, you know, all of whom probably you'll never hear of after, this August 2nd. But, yeah, she will face off in November. Remember, this is the top two primary, so it's the top two vote getters regardless of party. Almost always that means a Democrat and a Republican, except in places like Seattle where it's two Democrats or Eastern Washington where it's two Republicans. Yeah, in a lot of these races, particularly the legislative races, it's going to be the Democrat and the Republican advancing to November. And the majorities with which one or the other wins in the primary really are important for fundraising purposes, for positioning for November, setting expectations, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's gonna be the two major parties this year. There's very, very, very few alternatives that are not the two major parties that have a viable chance of appearing on the November ballot, let alone winning. So the House of Representatives, the four in the Seattle area are all currently held by Democrats. Susan DelBene in District 1, northeast of Seattle. She has been a moderate. In fact, she's the committee chair of the New Democrats, which is the replacement for the DLC, the sort of corporate centrist Democrats. So that's where she's coming from. And She unfortunately does not have a challenge from the left this year. It's just her versus the Republicans. It's a kind of a swingy district. So, unfortunately, if you're in that district, you vote for her. Same thing in District 9 with Adam Smith, south of Seattle. He is chair of the House Armed Services Committee. That should tell you where he's coming from on a lot of issues. He's been there for 30 years or so, and desperately needs a challenge from the left, particularly given that South King County, which is where much of his district is, doesn't look like old white guys anymore. It has completely changed over in the last 30 years, since it's largely immigrant, largely communities of color. He needs a challenge from the left, but he's not getting one this year, so we're stuck with Adam Smith for another term. District 8, east of Seattle, the east side and out into Kittitas County, east of the mountains, that is a swing district that was held by Republicans until only, I think, 4 years ago. Kim Schreier is a Democrat who took it away from the Republicans, and she needs to be supported simply to keep the Republicans from taking that seat back. And then District 7 in Seattle, Pramila Jayapal, she's been in that seat now for 6 years. She has managed to parlay it into a national position. She's chair of the Progressive House Democrats. She has been working nationally to try and get more progressives elected within the within the Democratic Party. And that's all to the good. And she's great on a lot of different issues. So, an enthusiastic Pramila Jayapal.
She's done much better than I expected her to do.
Me too. She really has. I endorsed her when she first ran for the seat, and I said it's risky, but there's an upside, and she's really fulfilled that upside. So I'm very happy with the job she's done, particularly given that she replaced Jim McDermott, who, while I liked him personally, he had good rhetoric sometimes, but he had no influence within his party. Jayapal has become a master of parlaying her seat into a position of influence within her party in far less time than McDermott had. So I think she's been a massive upgrade in that seat.
And she had an incident, I believe it was the beginning of this week. It might have been the tail end of last week.
It was the tail end of last week. It got reported this week.
Okay. So, yeah, somebody with a standing outside her house saying stuff, you know.
Like, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, packing a gun and, got arrested in the police. SPD, I think, let him go pretty quickly thereafter, so.
Yeah.
Didn't get too much attention. Well, I mean, it got some national attention, but...
Yeah, it's kind of scary. And it just tells you that, Seattle is not immune from having right-wing crazies out there.
Not at
all. Or crazies in general.
Yeah.
So, there is one statewide office that's up for re-election. election this year. That is the Secretary of State, where the incumbent, Kim Wyman, took a job in the Biden administration with election security. Wyman was the latest in a long string of Republican secretaries of state, moderate Republican secretaries of state, which is how she got a job in the Biden administration. She was replaced by Governor Inslee with a Democrat named Steve Hobbs. And Hobbs is up for a special election this year to fill out the remainder of Wyman's term. He's the best of the choices on the ballot for Secretary of State. And, given what Republicans have done in many, many, literally dozens of other states with that Secretary of State position, claiming election fraud and we've got to prevent people from voting and the rest of that. We haven't had that happen in Washington State. let's not let it happen. And the safest way to do that is to re-elect Steve Hobbs, or elect, because he hasn't actually been elected so far.
Very good.
And then that brings us to the long list of House of Representatives seats and state Senate seats. Let's start with the House. Some of these are going to be East King County, or rather, Outer King County. District 5, that's in East King County. Bill Ramos is the incumbent there. He's a Democrat. And that's one of the kind of swing districts that the Democrats will need to hang on to if they can hold on to the House this year. So I'm pretty much going to recommend Democrats all the way down the line here. District 30 in Federal Way, both of the positions, are competitive this year. Jamala Taylor, is in position 1. She is the incumbent. She is taking over as chair of the House Black Democratic Caucus now that Harris Talley, is not running for re-election. And then position two, Christine Reeves would be the choice there. District 34 in West Seattle, position 1. And there are a number of people running for this seat. Emily Alvarado is the best choice there. 36 in Ballard. There's a bunch of people running for this one also. Julia Reed. I'm kind of reluctant to choose her. I mean, it's her or Nicole Gomez are the two best choices. And, Reed, probably has the most relevant experience with Olympia. She has, been a staffer in Olympia. She was also a staffer in the Durkin administration working on equity issues, which, that was one of the less toxic of the Durkin administration departments. It's a low bar, I know.
I want to see that in the graphic for that one.
Yeah.
Departments.
Exactly. District 37, position 2. This is Kirsten Harris Talley's seat, which she'll still have until January. And a bunch of people are running for this. Chipolo Street, I think, is the best choice there. And bear in mind, especially with these Seattle seats, that once you're in, you're going to be in for life unless you want to move on. So, choose wisely because you're going to be stuck with them for a long time. District 41, this is Mercer Island and a portion of South Bellevue. And Mylan Tai has been great in that position, much more progressive than you would expect from that part of the suburbia. So she needs to be reelected. The polar opposite of that is District 45, position 2, Larry Springer in Kirkland. He's a former Kirkland city council person. He's a small business owner. And he is exactly the kind of Democrat that you would like to see a progressive challenge. But it is a swing district. He's going to face a Republican in the fall. And so, at this point, he's the best there because there really isn't any good alternative. District 46, this is Northeast Seattle. Position 2 is open, and that, the best choice there would be Daria Farivar. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. District 47, this is South King County, position 1, Deborah Jean Entenmann. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And position 2, Shukri Olo. And I hope I'm pronouncing that right, too. But it really underscores the diversity that you're seeing in South King County right now. That's starting to percolate up to the local races for various city councils and the Washington State House races as well. You're seeing a much more diverse delegation from South King County. So I think Ogle would be a good complement to that. That was the house, and that's the chamber that is most at risk of being taken over by Republicans. So, to the extent that you can support a Democrat, it was a good chance of winning in November. It helps them get momentum, helps with fundraising and volunteers and visibility and all that good stuff. So, the state senate, there's several the Seattle area races worth mentioning. District 30. Again, that is, Federal Way. And, Claudia Kaufman was, elected as a relatively progressive state senator there 4 years ago. Wrong district. Claire Wilson was the one who was elected from there 4 years ago. There were several new state senators in South King County 4 years ago. They're up for re-election now. In District 30, Claire Wilson is one. She is, I believe, a former school teacher, and she's done a good job in Olympia. So, and she will face a competitive race in November from Republicans. So she is worth supporting, excuse me, in that district. District 32 in up on Shoreline. Jesse Solomon, won from the corporate wing of Democratic Party in Shoreline, 4 years ago. He's really done nothing, honestly, in Olympia other than just sort of be there and fill the seat. He is getting a challenge from the left with, Dr. Patricia Weber, she is not likely, I think, to make it through the primary. That again is something where one Democrat and one Republican will likely make it through. And Solomon is the prohibitive favorite since he is the incumbent. But, the 32nd district, progressives kind of got routed. 4 years ago, Marilyn Chase did have this seat for years, and she was defeated in her reelection bid. So they kind of really need to regroup, and hopefully they can build on Weber's campaign for the future. So I would support her. In West Seattle, Joe Nguyen, who Nguyen, Vietnamese immigrant, who ran for King County executive against Dow Constantine last year, fortunately, he lost, which means he's still in the state senate, where he's really done a great job. He was another one who got in for the first time 4 years ago. Really a rising star, I think, among progressive Democrats in the state. That's in West Seattle. 46th district in Northeast Seattle. Javier Valdez is another one of those kind of useless Democrats who does nothing of his own. He just votes for his caucus, which, at this point, given that we only have one rational, political party in the U.S., that's kind of the bare minimum. And then District 47, Claudia Kaufman, that again is South King County. She's running against, Kent County City Commissioner, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher his name, Satwinder Kaur, I think, maybe, kind of. But I think Kaufman is the incumbent, and she is the better choice. Wow, we made it through.
So a lot of names there.
Yeah, and I am going to have up on my Facebook page, my usual written summary of those races and, why I'm choosing the people that I'm choosing or not choosing them, as the case may be. For Jesse Solomon, for example. So that should be up by tomorrow.
Okay. And there's always generally there's plenty of back and forth once you post that about people going in and giving you their opinions.
Which I welcome. I welcome dissenting opinions because, a lot of these local races, people know more than I do. So, I'm willing to take advice. And, Maria should be back next week and she may have some differing opinions on some of these races as well.
Inevitably she will be having different opinions.
Yes. Or opinions, at any rate.
But, yeah, it's always enjoyable seeing, people, convince you online that, you should change your vote. And
yeah, that was wrong. Yeah. It does happen from time to time.
So, and please, everyone, be respectful.
Yes. And, you know,
or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like I say, I'm happy to, be schooled on some of these races. And maybe I'll change my mind. Maybe I won't. Like I said at the beginning, it's one person's opinion. Go do your own research and make up your own mind. We are about nothing on this show, if not individual empowerment.
Moving on, but still somewhat related, Seattle City Council this week weighing in on ranked choice voting.
Yes. Now, this was in response to – this is on Thursday, and it was an emergency meeting. This is in response to earlier in the week, an activist group submitting a sufficient number of signatures to get their initiative on the ballot in November. And that ballot was for something called preferred voting, which is another form of basically it's a simplified ranked choice voting system where you can indicate as many candidates as you want in any given race as, you know, candidates that you prefer. And then the way it works is that your vote goes to that candidate that gets the most overall votes. And that's it. And, ranked choice voting, on the other hand, allows you to rank a certain number of candidates, in terms of your preferred choices, like first, second, third, fourth, fifth. And then, they tally it. And if your first choice is eliminated, your vote moves to your second choice and so on down the line. Eventually you get, you know, two finalists.
I thought they were calling it approval voting for this.
Yes, that's it. Approval voting. That's right. It's a generic name that I haven't quite internalized yet. You know, the ranked choice voting has been around longer. It's been tried in a number of other cities. And, you know, the city council felt like, well, you know, if we're going to have this one reform on the ballot, we should give people a choice between the two. So you get a choice of which improved voting system to use. And there was some opposition to the council putting this on the ballot, basically from people who thought it would be too confusing to have, you know, to pit two reform measures against each other. One is more reformy than the other, I think. But both are an improvement on the winner-take-all system we seem to have stuck in now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll be talking about that a lot more as we get closer to November.
Oh, yeah, that should be heating up. As well as one appears to be more of a grassroots effort as opposed to kind of an AstroTurf effort.
Yeah, I think the preferred decision, whatever it's called,
approval.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, it's as many candidates as you approve of, I guess. That seems to be more of an AstroTurf to try and undermine ranked choice voting.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting, and it's going to be heating up. And inevitably, it will be making its way back onto mentions on our show.
Probably, yeah.
Can't stop it. All right. So anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. You had down Anchorage Police
yes.
Department.
Anchorage, Alaska. This was a very weird incident that happened last week. Donald Trump went up there to speak to Anchorage, And apparently, after his big show, a woman was pulled over by the police department. She was weaving down the road and suspected of DUI. And she filmed the encounter with police, where she couldn't find the driver's license, because, of course, that's the first thing they ask for. So she fished out of her purse instead a novelty card called a white privilege card, handed this to the officer, and he looks it over, hands it back, and sends her on her way. She filmed this encounter, put it up on YouTube, and it went viral. And now there's all kinds of calls for investigations for the local police department. The irony is the woman with this card was actually Filipina, and judging from her picture, a fairly dark-skinned Filipina. So even at night, it should have been pretty obvious that the woman wasn't white. And she's a Trump supporter. So go figure. So it's unclear as to whether it was the white privilege card that got her off, whether the fact that she was coming from a Trump appearance that got her off. But in any event, there is now an investigation underway, and it's a big brouhaha up there. So this once again is a reminder that the ACAB, because, you know, she was. Clearly, should have been subjected to a breathalyzer or something. She wasn't. So, what's up with that, right? So, a lot of people up there are upset about that.
All right. Let's move on to this, the never-ending segment, this week's pandemic news.
Yeah, well, we're starting to get the first studies in now on BA5, which is now the dominant subvariant of Omicron in the United States, and it's not looking good. BA5 looks to have the ability to evade the immune system that we saw with other Omicron variants and subvariants, but it has the virulence, that is the severity of disease, of Delta. Going back to last year. So it's both more virulent than subvariants excuse me, that we've seen recently, and more transmissible. This could be a big problem this summer. We're starting to see BA5 really take over and take off in a lot of parts of the country. Houston, for example, has seen its cases double in the last 2 weeks. Cases are not going up so far in King County, which we can be thankful for. We're still seeing a slow decline, but it's likely to start inching upwards again soon. And we heard from Jeffrey Duchin, who's the head of Public Health Seattle King County, who said King County is actively considering an indoor mask mandate again because they see this coming. And of course, with summer and, you know, people are out partying and going to concerts and sporting events and all the rest of that thing, and the Mariners are having a good season, and the Seahawks will be playing soon. It could be a real problem. So once again, you know, if you stop wearing masks when you go out and around, you should start again. If not for yourself, for your family, for the people around you, your neighbors, just try and slow down the community spread just a little bit. And it protects you also. You know, paper masks are the bare minimum. At this point, an N95 or a KN95, and then put a paper mask over top of that. Use two layers, because this is getting serious now. And we want to try and head off, a large spike in the middle of summer, and then again, that's coming fall in King County. And the best way to do that is if we get buy-in on simple public health measures that, unfortunately, our electeds seem to have abandoned. But the public health people are talking about it again. and they're talking about it again in other parts of the country too.
So. Remind me how many, percentage-wise, how many people are immunocompromised in this country and or, you know, are similar effects?
It's about 7 million out of, out of 330 million. So, you know, it's between 2 and 3%, which doesn't sound like a lot until you put it in raw numbers. Right. So that for Seattle, for example, that would mean, trying to do quick math in my head, it's about, let's see, where's the decimal point go here? Is it 14 or 140? I think it's going to be 140,000 in King County. Yeah. So that's still a lot of people.
I just wonder, you know, when I'm like in the grocery store and I choose to wear a mask, and boy, there's the percentage of people wearing them now is pretty minimal.
It really is. Yeah.
The store I go to, but I'm just curious, you know, I mean, cause it seems like, you know, there's on average, just around, let's say 100 people in the store when I'm there. And so that's like 2 or 3 people that potentially are in the store with me who are immunocompromised. And I just think it's amazing that, these people that choose not to wear a mask, can spot those people immediately and know to distance themselves from them. You know, I mean, it's just amazing superpower
It is a special superpower. Yeah. Actually, what's happening is a lot of immunocompromised people, of course, many of them are, those people are on disability and have, you know, limited income. But they have to bear the cost of getting groceries delivered to home because they don't dare set foot in those stores because nobody's wearing a mask.
Right.
So, you know, it's been a really difficult time. And, the people I know who are immunocompromised, and I know quite a few because I am one, and I know of others, feel pretty abandoned by politicians because, you know, you hear this rhetoric on the right of, well, it's a reflection of values and that's what we hire politicians for because, you know, we don't want public health bureaucrats setting policy. Well, maybe you do because maybe they know best. But what do I know? It's a value to try and not murder people. Don't get me started. I'm very, very angry with how this country has responded to the pandemic.
That's on top of decades of treating people who are already compromised with a crappy health system. You know, I mean, if you can even call it a health system, you know.
Yeah. And not only that, but, you know, the Social Security disability, which a lot of these folks are on, you know, it's not enough to live on, certainly not in a place like Seattle. And, you know, you also have the chronic underfunding of public health agencies for decades, going back to the Reagan years. You know, we saw it at the national level with the FDA and the CDC, and we've seen it at the local level also. To be fair, Seattle King County Public Health has, I think, done a relatively good job during the pandemic. They've certainly had, they've put out timely warnings. They certainly have, had a robust website in terms of tracking the course of the pandemic. Much more responsive than the state has been. But at the same time, you know, this stuff has been underfunded for years and years. So it's been a problem all the way around. So also on the pandemic, we have a new subvariant, a new Omicron subvariant.
Oh, good.
BA.2.75. Now, some wag on Twitter, decided to name this Centurion after a galaxy, I think. And that seems to be catching on in media. So if you see Centurion, that's what this is 2.75. And it's another Omicron subvariant. We don't know enough about it yet to, know whether it's more virulent or more transmissible than any of the other subvariants that are out there. But we do know that it's in at least a dozen countries so far, including the United States. It's been in several states, not Washington State, so far as I'm aware. But keep an eye on that. Just, you know, stick a pin on it, as Rachel Maddow likes to say.
Is that like in a voodoo doll you're sticking a pin in, or?
Pretty much, yep, in the hopes that it won't haunt you.
All right, anything else on pandemic news this week?
No, let's move on.
Okay. January 6th committee, Development Center?
Yeah. The committee had a hearing again on Tuesday, and it was, again, fascinating. They spelled out the links between the various fascist brown shirt organizations that Donald Trump was loyal to and that were in turn loyal to him, namely Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, etc. And we found out that they were, in fact, coordinating with the White House on January 6th. Now, it will be very interesting. There's one more hearing coming up. This will be in prime time. This coming Thursday, the 21st. And that is that's the last scheduled here, these public hearings. It'll be the 7th. And that's the one where they're going to be talking about what Trump himself was doing in the 3 hours between when the Capitol was stormed on January 6th and when, the belated arrival of the National Guard started to clear people out of the Capitol. And then, Donald Trump told people to go home after they were already being arrested or routed out. By all reports so far that we've heard, that Donald Trump was sitting in the West Wing watching TV and cackling to himself with glee as the Capitol was trashed, and refusing to do anything to mobilize the National Guard or get police reinforcements out there, tell people to go home. People within his circles were begging him to do that, and he wasn't, because he was too busy enjoying the ego boost of having people riot on his behalf. So we're going to hear a lot more detail about that coming up on this coming Thursday, and I expect that one to be explosive, because we've seen the committee build a very careful case, and there are several former federal prosecutors on that committee, and they know what they're doing. We've seen a very meticulous building of a case of criminal conspiracy with Donald Trump at its center. And I expect that this will be the grand finale. This will be like, the fireworks show where they save it all for the end, and there's all the pretty colors that go, and Donald Trump will issue an angry denial that nobody will pay attention to. So that'll be coming up this coming Thursday. The committee has still been taking testimony from people. Now Steve Bannon is saying, yeah, I'll testify. Now, that may not mean anything, because he may not tell the truth, or he may just take the fifth, 140 or 500 times. But he had been facing a criminal trial for contempt of Congress for failing to respond to the subpoena in the past. So he's probably just trying to head that off. And it's not clear whether the committee will do that, or whether the DOJ will drop the charges or not. Because, just because you can't necessarily get out of that legal trouble by saying, okay, well, I'll do it now. But maybe they will, just to be nice. I don't know. I don't think any of these people deserve that kind of consideration at this point. Congress adjourns for the month of August. So after the 21st, unless something comes up very quickly, I would expect not to be hearing a lot from this committee until they issue their final report, which will happen after Congress comes back in September, just in time for the midterms. So, yeah, so they'll be back for September, then they'll adjourn in October again so they can go campaign. So, that's kind of the timeline that we're looking at. And, you know, I think the committee has done a relatively good job of focusing people on what happened on the 6th and the fact that we did very nearly lose our democracy, that it was a very, very close call. And a number of things had to go right in order for us to actually have a relatively free and fair election, and have the results of that honored, last year. So, but we're not out of the woods yet by any stretch. Donald Trump is still the presumptive Republican nominee unless he's sitting in prison. So, yeah, we'll see how that goes. But we've seen a concerted effort in red states across the country, as we were talking about earlier, to try and limit the right to vote and limit who can vote, you know, to the original vision of the Constitution, which was, you know, landed white men, property of white men. So, yeah.
And in addition to that, in running parallel to all this, is the decisions coming out of the Supreme Court that are pushing us further downwards. So that then leaves us talking about one of our elected officials nationally, which is Joe Manchin.
Yeah, senator from West Virginia, heavily invested in coal industry, which dominates that state politically. And the ever-shrinking infrastructure bill that they have been negotiating with Manchin and Sinema for months, because they don't have the votes to eliminate the filibuster, and they need their votes in order to pass it. Well, they reached a deal, they meaning Chuck Schumer and the Senate Democrat leadership, reached a deal with Manchin this week to further whittle down the infrastructure bill so that it no longer contains tax credits to help fight climate change, and it it retains subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. A lot of Democrats are justifiably furious at this, and wondering who elected Joe Manchin president. It really was a blow to trying to get anything passed in this particular Congress for climate change. Now, hopefully, the Democrats can increase their majority in the Senate come November, which didn't look likely early this year, but is looking increasingly likely in a number of key states, places like Arizona, Nevada, Ohio, because of the blowback against the abortion ruling by the Supreme Court and the loss of Roe v. Wade. Now, there's a lot of pressure on Congress to try and codify abortion rights. It's not at all clear whether if Congress passes something like that nationally, the Supreme Court would just, you know, throw it out. But, they can certainly try. So anyway, that happened this week. And then we're getting a lot of international news around climate change. Of course, you know, one of the other aspects of climate change, last year we had 110 degree heat. This year we're having a very cool summer, relatively cool.
Here in the Pacific Northwest.
In the Northwest. Yeah. But in Europe right now, they're having what we had last year. They're having widespread wildfires, very high heat. Western Europe is seeing, you know, 105, 108 degree heat in areas that don't have any air conditioning. And, you know, for comparison, relatively high latitudes also. So we're seeing that kind of heat in, you know, Britain and France, for example, are at about the latitude of Edmonton, I believe. They're pretty far north. They're warm by the Gulf Stream, generally, but they don't get that kind of extreme heat. It's very, very rare, or at least it used to be.
Yeah, I saw a map of Spain, a heat map for Spain for July 14th, where the peak heat reached for surface temperature of 138 degrees.
Wow. Now, Spain is a little farther south because that's equivalent to the Mediterranean, and it's not that far north from North Africa, right across the water from North Africa. So that's more like the midsection of the U.S. in terms of latitude. Mm-hmm. But it's still really, really hot. The last time Europe had a heat wave this high, it killed tens of thousands of people from the heat because of the lack of air conditioning. And I'm expecting that we'll start to see those kind of headlines in the next couple of days, too. And Britain's going to get hit by this probably by early next week. So that's going to be a big deal. And there's wildfires in the south of France, too, near Bordeaux and down toward the Mediterranean, the French Alps, those areas. So, all this is climate change going apace while global governments, most notably the U.S. and China, continue to do very little.
It makes you wonder what they're talking about when they're getting together, with the G7 type meetings. It's like, what the heck are you guys talking about? Divvying up the final, the final amount of treasure from your individual countries before you guys are kicked out of office or what?
Something like that. This year they've been talking about Ukraine, which of course continues to go on. And we had another atrocity this week, some 23 people killed in a central Ukrainian town by a Russian shell targeting a civilian area. Mother and daughter who had a fairly sizable Instagram following posted something, and an hour later, the 4-year-old daughter was dead from the bombing. So it's just incomprehensible, and it keeps going on. The U.S. and Western European NATO allies are continuing to funnel arms into Ukraine. And, at this point, I really don't know. I don't know whether, putting additional additional arms into Ukraine, whether that's just prolonging the misery or not. War is hell, and the Russians have made very clear that they're going to continue targeting civilian areas until Ukraine somehow decides to surrender. And Ukraine has made very clear that they have no intention of surrendering ever. So it's something of a stalemate at this point, and it's a stalemate where the civilian population of women and children, which are primarily the ones who are left behind because the men are all fighting, whether those folks are just going to continue to be subjected to random misery death and dismemberment and injury. Until what? What's the end point here? Nobody really seems to know. It's very sad. What humans do to humans.
Yeah, and what humans do to planets.
Yes. And unfortunately, we only have one of those. So, it's not like we have a lot of alternatives once we ruin this one.
But we spotted some really good prospective galaxies on the James Webb telescope this week. So
that's true, and
we won't reach them
if we can travel at the speed of light. We'll only be there in a few thousand years. That's a show. As I mentioned, if you were kind of swinging all the details about the different names and legislative districts and all the rest of that. I will have that up on my Facebook page, Geov, G-E-O-V, Parish, with two R's. And happy to friend you. So, yeah, that should be up by tomorrow. And remember to vote by Tuesday, August 2nd. And you should have your ballots in the mail. If you haven't got it already, you should have it by Monday. So look forward to that. And we'll probably go over it all again next week with Maria.
There's a fair chance of that.
Yep.